got a 50-year-old man in cardiac arrest, and our building just lost power.
All right, give me jumper cables, rubber gloves, 3,000 grams of Solmedrol. Stat.
What are you, MacGyver?
No, I'm the Generalist.
I don't know about you, Adrian, but in medical school, I really wasn't taught much about eczema or atopic dermatitis, except for the fact that it's itchy and basically you treat it with steroids. And I kind of feel shortchanged because there's so much more to it than that. And one of the most important concepts to grasp, and something we will chat about more, is to remember that for most folks, eczema is a chronic disease.
Yeah, right. And it's a condition with a lot of ups and downs that can really take a toll on our patients and their families. And it's not just quality of life that can be threatened. In some cases, eczema can be serious. It can be even life-threatening. You and I both remember vividly a patient that we had up north who actually died from septic shock secondary to really poorly controlled eczema. Now, obviously, that's the exception, but suffice to say that eczema may not be just a benign condition that we all think it is. So this is something we need to be able to understand well and be able to teach to our patients and their families.
Of course, those are the voices of our very own Vanessa Carty and Adrian Salim, long-term podcast pals and even longer-term practice partners. This month on The Generalist, they are tackling eczema, specifically eczema in kids. Now, before we delve into the meat of it, I just wanted to give you a quick review of the pathophysiology of eczema. Here it is. In eczema, the skin barrier is disrupted, it's messed up, it's crazy, it's terrible, and it's bad. While that is undoubtedly the oversimplification of the decade, sorry, dermatology buffs, it serves our purposes of developing a framework for the diagnosis and management of eczema in the general practice setting. Back to Adrian and Vanessa.
Well, now let's tackle the approach to the patient, okay? So let's start with history and physical. As with any chronic disease, the first thing is to start in a pretty open way by asking about the parents' or patient's general satisfaction with how things are going. Or if the patient is a child, ask the child themselves if they're old enough to weigh in. If all is well and the patient or parent is feeling in control and not having any real problems, and they only have an occasionally easy managed flare, then your work is quickly done. You just need to refill the scripts and go grab your coffee, and you can just carry on. But that rarely happens. So why don't you tell us what happens if that's not the case?
All right, so what happens if you scratch the surface even just a little bit? No pun intended there. Well, one of the things you might find is that patients and their families are not sleeping well at all. Now, at least 60% of pediatric patients who have atopic dermatitis have disrupted sleep, and that number goes up to a whopping 80% during a flare. Now, these kids may not be performing well in school. There may be signs of like a secondary ADHD. Their parents are probably more cranky as well. Basically, a whole lot of stress for the family.
You mentioned a really important factor here, and that's sleep. So you need to ask about that. You need to ask about the impact on the family, how the parents and the patient feel about it. And for older kids and adolescents, find out about any psychological fallout in terms of body image, shame, teasing, all those things of teenagehood. But what are we going to see on physical, Adrian?
All right, eczema is, of course, very laborious to describe, which you will know if you've ever listened to even the most talented medical student confronted with this task. It's wet, it's dry, it's scaly, it's lichenified, it's vesicles, it's papules. It's just a huge mess.
You're so right. So really, it is far easier to describe it by its typical location, which can be somewhat age-dependent. So what we're going to do here is we're going to do a little quiz. I'm going to give you an age group, and you have to tell me the classic locations for that age group. All right, here we go. What about the little babies? Where does it show up on them?
So I think the little babies, little cute little babies that come in, they've got those like red, rosy cheeks, and they've got some, you know, eczema going on in their cheeks and their head and their face. So head and face, sometimes trunk and extensor surfaces of their limbs.
And what about in the older kids, the school age kids?
Yeah, so that's where you see that typical eczema forming on the flexural areas of their limbs. So elbow creases behind the knees. You can also see it on their wrists and sometimes on the back of the neck as well.
And how about the kids getting older, adolescents, and moving into those terrible teen years?
Don't speak to your mum and I like that.
Oh, I didn't say anything.
Yeah, so I think of myself after doing a whole bunch of emergency shifts in the winter time. So I get it really bad on my hands, which is what happens when kids get older.
I love that you think you're an adolescent, but you know, that's fine. Moving on. You have a tad bit of denial, but we'll deal with it. And just to make it a bit more confusing, the rash itself also changes somewhat so that in babies, you might see more weeping and crusting. And in older kids and adolescents, you know, people like Adrian, you're going to see perhaps more lichenification.
So we've made the diagnosis now of eczema. So what are we going to do now? What do we need to be telling the family and the patient? What's our approach to this? Well, the first thing that we can counsel patients on is clothing. So you want to have patients wearing kind of breathable cotton clothes, long sleeves, long pants. For babies who are scratching, especially at night, you can counsel parents to put on some mittens on the baby so they're not kind of scratching and irritating the skin. And that also happens to be one of the cutest things in the world, to have a little baby with mittens sleeping at night.
It sounds like Adrian might be a little broody. Okay, moving on to diet. Diet can definitely have an impact, and particularly more on kids and adults, but it's notoriously hard to sort out. And interestingly, research shows that it's probably overestimated by parents in terms of its influence, but underestimated by doctors, which isn't a great combination. The more severe the atopic dermatitis, the higher the probability that it is implicated with a food issue. Research suggests that food allergies play a role in exacerbating atopic dermatitis in up to 33% of patients with severe symptoms, 10 to 20% with moderate symptoms, and 6% with mild symptoms of eczema.
So the most common dietary offenders in atopic dermatitis are eggs, followed then by wheat and milk. Now, thankfully, these allergies are generally outgrown as these patients get older. Number two, the evidence does not support random trials off these foods in unselected kids.
So that basically means if the parents suspect a food is making the eczema is worse, then you can consider doing formal testing with IgE levels and skin prick testing. That's certainly a reasonable option. But remember that a lot of these tests, a lot of kids will end up in the gray zone, and both false positives and false negatives are common. So if you have parental suspicion plus positive testing, it certainly warrants a trial off the suspected food.
I'm interjecting here on behalf of the diagnostic purist who may be objecting to our interchangeable use of atopic dermatitis and eczema, because technically they are slightly different diagnoses. Eczema is generally thought of as the umbrella term, and atopic dermatitis is viewed as a subtype of eczema. So thanks for bearing with us as we use our general practitioner verbiage.
All right, but now we're moving on to bathing. Now, we're just going to talk about generally here. There's issues of bathing with eczema, right? There's all this discussion about the length of baths, how hot they should be, whether you should be rubbing the patient dry or patting the patient dry. So much to discuss here. But the first thing that we're going to delve into here is this kind of controversial topic which came up recently, which are the bleach baths. Adrian, what can you tell us?
Okay, so here's a theory. In atopic dermatitis, patients are very colonized with staph. It's really just all up in their business. It's really just dug in there. And what happens is it ramps up inflammation with things like super antigens and exotoxins. And now what happens is sort of like zebra mussels, in that the staph is just crowding out the other normal flora of the skin. So the theory here is maybe if we could get rid of that staph, or reduce its numbers at least, we should in theory reduce the eczema, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. It makes sense in theory.
Right.
So there was this landmark study in 2009 with this unexpected new approach to bath time. And it really made a big splash. Oh, you love my humor.
Good one.
Because it was exciting to have something new to try, even if parents never really shared our enthusiasm to the same degree. So the original study involved kids from about 6 months and up with overtly infected atopic dermatitis who also received antibiotics by mouth. And then the treatment group went on to get bleach baths twice a week, along with intranasal mupirocin for 3 months. And the treatment group did actually fare better, except when it came to the lesions on their head and neck.
Yeah, I remember when this study came out and we were all kind of extrapolating it to kids who had eczema, when it really looked at kids who had infected eczema and they were given PO and topical antibiotics, right? So a more recent study of kids and adults in 2013 looked at just doing bleach baths, no antibiotics, and that was for 2 months. Now, this study also showed a benefit, but the benefit was only apparent to clinicians. So the patient's assessment was basically the same between the treatment and the placebo groups. There was no improvement of itch either. So basically, there was a visible improvement without really any clinical relevance. And finally, there was another study. This one was from 2015, and this just wanted to confuse us even more because it showed that patients who had plain water baths actually did better compared to the bleach bath group. So all this to say is that we should probably be reserving bleach baths for kids with secondary bacterial infections or as a trial for patients with more severe eczema. Now, if you're going to be doing this, the recipe is a half cup of bleach and a full bath. You're going to want to avoid it on the eyes and face, and you probably want to do this maybe like 2 to 3 times a week.
Sometimes advances in medical research fly in the face of conventional wisdom. For generations, parents have been telling their kids, don't play with, touch with, drink, or do anything with the household bleach. But now there's a generation of parents who are telling their kids with infected eczema, you need to bathe in bleach. Go figure. And just to reiterate Adrian's point, there's a paucity of information supporting bleach baths for kids with non-infected eczema. Now sit tight, because bath time's not over yet.
All right, so let's get back to bathing for a minute. I'm talking regular baths here, not those bleach baths that we were talking about just a minute ago. So parents can use a gentle cleanser. So even things like mineral oil or lotion can actually work for this. And it's okay to take daily baths, as long as it's not too long and not too hot. Now, standard teaching is to apply moisturizer right after the bath, but that's not necessarily true. It should be done at some point within 30 minutes after the bath. And in reality, really right after the bath is probably the most convenient time to do it. I don't know about you, Cardi, but having to put pajamas on my kids and then take pajamas off to put cream on again is just, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah, definitely not. Those kids are getting lubed up as soon as they take that first step out of the bath.
Like a greased up pig out of the bath.
Have you got any grease?
Yes. Yes, we do.
Then grease me up, woman.
Okie dokie.
So I remember being taught that you should limit bathing to just a few times a week for kids with eczema because there's just a net loss of moisture basically after every bath. Even though that is true in theory, daily baths don't seem to actually make eczema any worse.
All right, moving on to wet wraps. This maybe sounds like a new kind of hipster sandwich to the uninitiated, but it's actually a method for intensifying moisturization of the skin, and it can be done with or without steroid ointment. So what you do here is that you get your kid and you make sure that they're naked, and then you apply lotion all over them, and then you take a pair of pajamas, or if they've just got lesions on their hands and feet, you can take some cotton tube socks, and you dunk them into warm water, okay? Not the kid, you dunk the pajamas or the socks into warm water, then you wring them out, and you put it on the kids. And then you put a dry layer of the same thing over top of them. And this top layer can be peeled back and sprayed wet again every 2 to 3 hours if you're doing this during the day. This might not sound like a great option for overnight because, you know, misting your kids all night isn't super convenient, but it really does seem to work and it decreases the itch.
I just pictured you gently spraying your kids with a little mister every few hours.
And now we're moving on to moisturizers. And these could be lotions, moisturizers themselves, emollients, creams, oils, ointment, gloop, glop, grease. I'm usually pretty sloppy with these terms, and I use them kind of semi-interchangeably, which of course is technically incorrect. But when referring to barriers for the skin, it really doesn't matter. All of the goopy stuff appears to help in ways that are independent of their classification. Now, petroleum jelly is as good an option as any, but sometimes parents aren't that keen in covering their kids in Vaseline. So you have to think of other options, and particularly if the parent prefers a more natural options. So in those cases, what could you offer?
If parents prefer the pantry to the pharmacy, then they can actually use sunflower oil or coconut oil. Those are both fine options. Or if they really want, even sometimes Crisco can work. Now, one thing to know here is that you should stay away from olive oil, which appears to damage the stratum corneum and even possibly promote inflammation. The bottom line is that all creams and ointments and oils and lotions have their fan base, and you should just let the parents decide whichever one works best for them. Obviously, nothing scented, and they should have plenty on hand because they're going to want to use it as much as possible. Now, also, kids can develop a sensitivity to a moisturizer. It doesn't necessarily mean that the eczema is getting worse. So if you or the parents suspect this, just try and change things up a bit, maybe try a new moisturizer.
And a final note on creams and everything is that you really want the parents to think of this as kind of an undergarment, and the kid is not really dressed until that first layer of moisturizing creams or oils or ointments or goop or grease goes on.
All right, so steroids. Parents should start applying steroids at the very first sign of a flare, even if it's just a little bit of increased itchiness before the visual changes appear. Now, a few things to know about topical steroids. Hydrocortisone 1% cream, it's basically standard for the face, but you can also use desonide as well. Ointments are generally better. They sting less, they're more potent. But if creams are preferred, then no problem, just use whatever the parents prefer. Betamethasone valerate 0.1% is a good choice for higher potency for the body. But go ahead and pick like 2 to 3 favorites in the low to mid range and the mid to high potency range and get used to using them frequently. Now, daily application is advised unless it's really not helping. Now, as long as there is inflammation and it seems to be improving somewhat, you don't really have to worry too much about complications.
Of course, steroid phobia is common and it's there whether you know it or not in at least half of your patients, maybe in up to 80% according to some studies. And this can be fueled by the internet, by ourselves, and of course, often by the pharmacist. But any parent who has even a trace of unease about topical steroids, you can reassure them that even using things like betamethasone twice weekly for maintenance can be done safely without fear of complications.
Okay, so sensitivity to the steroid carrier is a possibility, just as we talked about with moisturizers. So if things don't seem to be improving and the diagnosis is pretty clear, you can try and change things up a bit with the steroids. Now, if you have a suspected sensitivity in a product that's otherwise preferred for a patient, you can always do the equivalent of like a self-administered patch test, basically like an N-of-1 test or really an N-of-a-half test, where you have the patient apply a different steroid to their left and their right side and see if that makes any difference.
Another tool in the topical treatments of eczema toolbox is the calcineurin inhibitors. Names you'll recognize are tacrolimus and pimecrolimus. These are rather elegant medications which can be used to treat recalcitrant eczema and also to treat eczema in more sensitive skin areas like the head and neck, axilla, and groin. The beauty of these medications is they help reduce the longer-term effects of steroid on skin. And increasingly, these medications are being used for eczema maintenance, not just treatment of flares.
Okay, now moving on to infections. Sometimes this can be pretty hard to figure out because you might see little pustules or papules. There might be a bit of erythema. There could be a little bit of crusting, and it can be hard to tell. But if you're sure that there's an infection, you're probably going to need to do something about that. So you might use topical treatment or you might use oral. And if you're going to go the oral route, cefalexin tends to be a better choice than cloxacillin. Not that cloxacillin isn't a great antibiotic, but it tastes like death. And cefalexin, if you want with kids, you can split the dose BID instead of QID. It's just as effective and it's way easier. But Adrian, what about MRSA?
So we know staph colonization is quite high in kids with eczema, but for whatever reason, MRSA colonization is actually quite lower than in children without eczema. It's not clear exactly why that is, but if you suspect MRSA because of abscess formation or a positive skin culture, then you can go ahead and treat with something like TMP-SMX or clindamycin as your antibiotic of choice. Now, while we're talking about super and secondary infection, let's talk briefly about eczema herpeticum, which is basically an HSV infection in the context of severe eczema. Now, it can cause widespread or more localized disease. You often see vesicles or punched out lesions, and sometimes systemic symptoms as well. Now, if there are systemic symptoms, it actually carries quite a high mortality rate, up to 10%. So you need to have a high index of suspicion for this. And just like any other herpetic infection, corneal involvement is possible, and there can also be co-infection with staph just to complicate your life a little bit more.
We're nearing the end of this discussion on eczema, and I just wanted to do a little bit of a synopsis. So Adrian and Vanessa have taught us a lot of things. Probably what I think is the most important is to inquire about the functional impact of eczema. They've also reviewed that eczema does present differently in different age groups. They've instructed us that food allergens can play a role in some parts of eczema. They've reviewed different bathing techniques to help with eczema. They've talked about the importance of moisturizing on a regular basis, and they've reviewed the topical treatments for eczema. And of course, they scared the bejesus out of us by talking about eczema herpeticum. But what do we do about those cases that we can't manage, that we've done all of this for, and still the child is not getting any better? Well, at that point, it's appropriate to consult somebody else to help out. Treatment options that dermatologists offer can include phototherapy and oral immunomodulating drugs like azathioprine, methotrexate, and prednisolone. But I have a sneaking suspicion if dermatologists around the world knew of Adrian Salim's secret eczema treatments, they would adopt those in a heartbeat.
Cardi, have you ever used bear grease?
I have.
It works really well.
It does work really well. It doesn't smell great.
No. No, but it works. I think otter blood works well too.
Otter blood?
Have you heard of that? Yeah, I think. I've never even used that one, but I've heard patients saying that they're using otter blood. Maybe I'm mistaken. I think they use otter blood. If you happen to have any bear grease or otter blood lying around, give that a whirl.